20s again, and asked you what what the attitudes were of the people in labor and the people in the radical circles in which you traveled towards women, and what kinds of beliefs people had about women during that time period, the people you associated with.
Oh, I don't know. Can you ask more specifically what?
Well, for instance, this is the time period where Crystal Eastman and Henrietta Rodman and the women who were living in the village who were very radical feminists were writing.
Well, I suppose I've never known a radical who wasn't also a feminist. I don't suppose there's such a thing as a machismo who would be an economic radical, or a male chauvinist pig. But
and you followed it?
I don't remember any specific connection or ever discussing the question. You just took it for granted. For instance, in the Socialist Party, women were just as I said, the state secretary was a woman. No, there was no question about sex. The one thing we didn't have was minority races. I don't remember. I think I remember one colored man who used to belong to the local. But
you felt that most of the people really lived up to their beliefs that in their...
Well, I suppose they took it for granted. I mean, we never discussed it. And then, of course, another thing, if you're going back to my feminist activities, I was always very closely connected with the what we used to call birth control and now call Planned Parenthood. I used to write for Margaret Sanger's magazine.
Oh, yes, I wanted to ask you about that.
What was that? What was it called? Woman Citizen or something
Woman
like
Rebel,
it?
Woman Rebel.
Birth Control Review, it was afterwards.
Oh, and it, were you
yeah,
right
it was
for the first
well,
time?
Well, I didn't know her in those days. But when she got into the birth control work, I got to know her quite well. And I think her paper was then called The Birth Control Review. I used to write articles for that.
Now, that was later then, wasn't it?
And, of course, I...
When was
well,
that?
I don't
that
remember.
Later.
Oh, Lord.
But that was...
I should have kept a diary. I never did in my life.
That was when, after it was not
that
legal.
That was way though. Back in, I should say, in the 1920s. I don't remember exactly. You can tell from any life of Margaret Sanger, when she...
But when it was still illegal, you weren't involved in it. During the period that birth control was illegal and Comstock was prosecuting people.
No, how do you mean that?
Well,
I remember when I first heard about it. But I've kept up my interest in I belong always to the Planned Parenthood Federation. And then when Patricia McGinnis and Rhoda Gurney started their work here for the free abortion, I helped with all writing their publicity and all that, and I got to know them quite well. And about all I do now, of course, is just pay dues and things. I belong to Zero Population Growth, and I belong to the non-parent organization and half a dozen others. But that's the trouble, you see. I have so many interests that, for instance, my chief interest in recent years, I haven't done anything active in anything except in the secularist movement. I'm a fellow of the American Humanist Association. It's my that plaque there is my that thing hanging on the side is my authorization, so to speak. And he comes out. And I belong to half a dozen societies and do a great deal of writing on that subject. Mm-hmm. But, of course, now I'm at the point where I don't speak in public anymore. I can't. I just start coughing at them. Last thing I spoke to the Anna Corbett Circle this year at their annual meeting, I had to cut my... Then when we talked 40 minutes, at the end of 20 minutes, I had no breath left. Mm-hmm. I had to stop. So I decided that was my last public speech. At one time, I was a great deal of public speaking.
What usually on what topics?
You mean for them or in general?
No, in general, your public speaking.
Well, there was a short period when I actually was a professional lecturer. Those days they had lectures, you know. And then I spoke Well, I don't know. I remember I had one lecture I gave called Tomorrow's Morality. It was, they were just, the thing was, mostly women with women's clubs and all would hire a lecturer, and we're supposed to talk about anything in general they were interested in. And I usually would give them not too strong a dose of the kind of thing that they wouldn't hear from anybody else. But what my subject otherwise would be according to under what auspices I was speaking. I mean, I've done a great many pure literary lectures and that sort of thing. See, I've written a great deal on literary history and biography.
Now, after you left Boston, did you ever speak on feminism again?
Well, I didn't change any feelings if there wasn't anything. I mean, there was no movement. There was nothing to join. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'd say is that individually, if anybody had anything to say, why, I told them what I thought. But except for the Planned Parenthood, I don't remember any. Until Women's Lib started, there really wasn't anything in the way of an organization.
So really, after suffrage?
I remember I wrote dozens of letters that were published in newspapers. Whenever anybody would make an anti-feminist remark, I would call them up on it, and I had an article. I had two or three articles in various, mostly in Midwest farm women's magazines, on bearing more or less on the subject. I remember I had one on, do women really want children? And that sort of thing. It was very surprising the response I got. These are all farmers from Kansas and Iowa and that kind of thing. I got a lot of anonymous letters that were scurrilous. I remember one that started, "You creature in the form of a woman." But the ones that were signed were from the farm wives, and they were almost entirely commendatory. One woman wrote me that she had 8 children. She never wanted any of them. She never liked any of them.
This was in the 20s.
No, I can't even remember the name of the magazine. Somewhere in my enormous files there.
And what period was this? Was this in the 20s?
Well, I knew that the so-called maternal complex is nonsense. A great many women don't like their children, don't want children. There wouldn't be this strong movement for abortion. And, I wrote half a dozen articles on more or less that line, and always from with the feminist slant, even if it wasn't the exact subject.
What do you feel happened to women after they got the vote? Do you feel that anything really changed in terms of the role of women in this country?
You mean now?
No, in the 1920s, right after they got the vote. Do you feel that there was really
well,
any change?
During the war, of course, women got a lot of jobs that they... But at the end of the war, most of them were fired, and the men came back and took their jobs, and very few of them complained. A lot of them probably were glad to go back to housekeeping, except that they needed the money, and they were losing that. But there was no... the various suffrage societies kept on going everywhere until the suffrage was won, and the League of Women Voters started. They always were pretty mild. I never belonged to it. I don't know much about it except what I've read of their things. But I don't think there were plenty of feminists, and you knew who they were, and they wrote individually or spoke individually. But there was no organized movement that I can think of outside of birth control.
And you feel, though, within the socialist circles that all of those women were definitely feminists, and the men, too.
Of course, you see, all of the... at that time, most of the original leaders, not the original, not 1845, but the old people like Anna Howard Shaw, whom I knew, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were still alive. And they were all pronounced feminists and said so on every occasion. But outside of suffrage, I don't think there was any organization.
Now, what about the influence? Did Charlotte Perkins Gilman influence?
Oh yes,
you at
she
all?
Was. Yeah. Yes, you know, this Feminist Press is reprinting some of her books. She used to be Charlotte Perkins Stetson, and then she got married. Mm-hmm. Then she was Charlotte Perkins Stetson Gilman for a while. I've always admired her because she had the guts to kill herself when she had incurable cancer.
Well, her writing is rather prophetic also.
I guess I haven't got it anymore. But I'm reviewing, I write reviews for the Chronicle, Sunday Miss, as I call it, the Combined Chronicle Examiner, and I write for this World section, mostly books of true crime, but they asked me to do one of the Feminist Press books, which is the reprint of Rebecca Harding Davis's Life in the Iron Mills.
Oh, the one that Tilly Olson did.
And, well, they haven't published it yet. They've had it for weeks. They've got three of mine ahead and another one I'm supposed to write, and I just told Bill Hogan that I wasn't going to write it until they published at least one. They're awfully crowded. They so we haven't got space for all the stuff they had.
Now, did you feel that, do you think that Charlotte Perkins Gilman's ideas had much effect on most of the women that you knew?
I don't know. You see, I never knew her. I knew her primarily as a writer of fiction. She wrote some wonderful grim horror story called The Yellow Wallpaper, if you remember that.
Now, I've read some of her poetry.
Yeah, well, I don't remember her poetry. I'd forgotten she wrote any. But her stories were very good. And there were any number of people that you recognized as feminists, but there was nothing for them. They had no organ, no avenue to speak through. All they could do would be on their own, and they were mostly writers because it was only writers that you'd know about because they could write.
So women were really sort of left standing alone individually as feminists then, and after suffrage.
You mean?
Women who were feminists.
Yeah.
Were sort of left on their own as individuals.
Yes. Some of them did and some of them didn't. It's hard to say. I mean, you'd have to, as I say, most of the women who had been working, especially from the more conventional ones, joined the League or organized the League of Women Voters and worked that way. And the general, they were the kind of people who would say, once we get the suffrage, politics is going to be purified because women are so holy and saintly and all that. So they found out very soon that women were just as corrupt as men. We're all human beings. So I think a lot of them probably remained quiescent after that. But of course there always were some that kept it up. Then when the Bohemian crowd began to make Greenwich Village famous, most of those people, was like Edna St. Vincent Millay and all, were also militant feminists.
Towards men, like when you were a child, some of the experiences you had, and what you then felt was because someone was a man, and a woman was treated that way because she was a woman. Did this pretty much continue most
well,
of your life?
I just remembered, after all, I think I was 6 or 7 years old, but I can remember distinctly feeling, because the bride, though, as I remember, pretty husky on her own, was not nearly the size of the bridegroom. And most women I knew were smaller than the men that I knew, so that I took it for granted that if he abused her because he was stronger, it was also because men were stronger than women physically. And I was always one to fight, not to I had a very unhappy childhood for a good many reasons, and one was that though I rebelled all the time, I was also extremely shy and timid. And I never could, I'd start fighting and then I'd sort of dull a quest. It didn't change my opinions, but it changed my actions considerably.
Now, but did that attitude towards men prevail most of your life then, or did you
soften a bit? I should say no. Look, you're getting into psychological quagmires. I'd have to practically make a confession. I mean, a long account of, another thing that our generation believed in was reticence. You didn't talk about your personal affairs. In fact, I'm a little unexcused.
Do you feel that in your professional career as a writer, that being a woman ever had any effect
on
your career?
No, I don't think that. As I think I said, this is one of the few professions where there is no sexual... I've never known an editor, for instance, to say that he didn't want a story because it was by a woman. Of course, there are people, well, for instance, what they call a lady's novels, especially some of those mawkish gothics and things that other writers make fun of, but the women do it just as much as the man. And, I should say that there's less prejudice in that. For instance, it's almost impossible for a woman to get a good job as a conductor of an orchestra. But there's no trouble at all about becoming a successful writer if you can produce.
Mm-hmm. And did you always use the Miriam, or did you ever use just M?
I don't. The question simply never arose. That's my personal attitude toward men. I think I've proved in more ways than you know that I'm perfectly heterosexual.
But, many women have felt...
There are. Oh, yes. I've known plenty of women that were anti-woman.
Now, as a writer...
Especially women that have made a success on their own, and they despise the women who can't. There are certain kinds of... Well, publishing houses seem to grow them. There are women who make their way upward through the use of their own sex. Of course, if they do on stage too, and especially in the movies. And they're the kind that, of course, hate other women, naturally, because they're all competing.
Now, yes, do you feel that most of your life, your primary identification was as a writer?
Oh, yes. The only decision I had to make was when I was about 16 or 17, because I also had some talent for drawing and painting, modeling, and I had to decide whether I wanted to go to art school and train as an artist or be a writer, and I decided that I wanted to be a writer, so it's been years since I've done anything in the way of graphic art. I did take a very refresher course in sculpture a few years ago, but it became impossible to handle in this environment, so I quit.
So that even when you were writing as a labor writer, as a newspaper reporter, your identification was basically as a writer rather than as a reporter, even?
Not for them. I wrote plenty of stuff for other places for all kinds of magazines. Mm-hmm. I've always been. See, I write in so many fields. Nearly all my books are either history or biography. Mm-hmm. And at present, all my magazine stuff is either science fiction or mysteries. So, it's hard to say, but certainly when you're hired to do a particular specific thing, you don't do something else at the same time.
The early feminists didn't really believe in the institution. institution of marriage.
Well, a lot of their very early feminists, way back in the days of Lucretia Mott and people like that, were... Well, I don't know. Lucretia Mott's husband was her great helper. So it was Al Stone Blackwell's. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. I mean, there were some of these women whose husbands made life hard for them, but there are others that had husbands who they were smart enough to get husbands who agreed with them, just as I was. I never in my life heard men say a word that would seem, as so many men do, without meaning anything, you know, talking about women in a condescending sort of way.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell me that I haven't asked you about?
The answer is that all kinds of women are feminists. Some of them are lesbians. Some of them are bitter, soured spinsters who have been rejected all their lives and are taking it out and hating men. And some of them are people who are intellectually convinced. And a good many of them, I hope, are people like myself who think of human beings as human beings and not distinguished by sex any more than they are by color or age or anything else.
But you're feminist.
In other words, the kind of psychology that is against minorities of any kind is just the same whether it's against Negroes or against women or against Jews or against Catholics or against anything.
Now, your feminism basically is the belief that women can do anything, that because they bear children...
Well, I suppose... Women. The thing is, I don't like generalizations. As I wrote somewhere long ago, the only good generalization is that there are no good generalizations. There are women who could do... Women exist who could do every kind of physical work. They can get up on the steel frame of a building and work up there or dig down here in the subway. There are also men who could not. In other words, all you can say is most women are physically not so strong muscularly as most men. But at both ends, there are people who are just the opposite.
Now, how do you define the word feminism?
How do I define it?
How do you personally define it?
I never thought, and I don't know whether I could do anything satisfactory off the cuff like that, but I would say that feminism is a movement which claims, and to my mind proves, that there is no higher or lower, no real difference mentally or psychologically between men and women, and that the same opportunities should be open and the same rewards given irrespective of the sex of the person laboring or winning the reward. Do you know a book called The Pendulum Method? And that there are times when men are in the ascendant, there are times when women are in the ascendant. They go, I think, a little too far with some of their so-called proof. But it's an extremely interesting book, and it's worth looking up. Called The Dominant Sex. It's Matilda and Matthias Berting, Baerting. Maybe here.
The early feminists, particularly the radical early feminists,
I doubt it.
Didn't believe.
I think most of the feminist leaders, anyway, were interested in nothing but feminism. Of course, they might be interested in related things like birth control, but I doubt very much if they were. Most of them were. Well, Lucretia Mott was a Quaker, and the Quakers. The Eastern Quakers, not Nixon's Western Quakers, always were social-minded. But I think most of them, it took so much of their strength and energy and interest just to speak up for women that they just didn't have time to think of anything else. Some of them, of course, had views on other economic matters, and I should say generally, if they had, they were fairly open and tolerant. But as I think them over, of course, Margaret Sanger started as an anarchist, but as she became the leader of the birth control movement, I don't think she did anything else. Finally married a millionaire.
When did you start reading all of the feminists, like Charlotte Perkins Gilman and the other feminist writers?
I can't say. It was after I graduated from college, that's all I know. But one thing leads to another. A great many books have bibliographies, and they look interesting, and you go from one to the other.
So by the time you were soapboxing, you were reading all of this literature, though?
I don't think I've done any much reading on the subject. Most of it just came from my own emotional sand.
When the reading followed it later?
Yeah. Because that was the period of you know, in youth is when you read all the classics, and I was too busy getting acquainted with every well-known author.
Now, a lot of the early 20th century feminists didn't believe in marriage and didn't believe in family life, those sorts of things. How did you feel about those attitudes?
Well, about family life, what do you mean by that? My own or other people?
No, about how families should be structured to free women. Did you share some of those beliefs?
Well, of course. You must remember, we're pretty near the Victorian age, and they were still sending the unmarried daughter out into the snow with her baby in her arms and that kind of thing. They were darkening my door again. And I suppose when I was a young girl, when I was on my first newspaper job, I know I was still pretty prudish and easily shocked. I know how horrified I was when you told me that some man had misled her. I remember turning cold at the thought that somebody I actually knew had done something irregular like that. One of my editors had a very obnoxious man that hung around her, and I was young and brash enough to make some disparaging remark about him. And she said immediately, "Oh, he's in love with me, but I don't care anything about him." And then later on, I happened to have just written him, in which she said, "I can hardly wait for your dear arms to be about me." So, well, I knew was that she was a liar, but I'd known that already. But she didn't shock me, because by that time I decided she wasn't much of anything anyway. She once took me to New York and abandoned me in Chinatown without my fare back. Fortunately, all my great uncles and aunts lived in New York. All I did was call up and get my fare.
But by the time you met your first husband, your attitudes had changed, obviously.
Oh, you mean as to family structure?
Yeah.
Oh, I was still pretty... Well, theoretically, because I can remember the first night I met him when he said to me, "What a rebel!" Oh, he made some remark which I was a little old for it, but I was like a brash 17-year-old and showing off. So I had made some remark about nobody paid attention to legal marriage these days or something like that. Which and he told me later in the evening that I was a revelation, but actually I was just as virginal as you can imagine and as prudish. When I was in college, I fell in love with one of my professors who was married, but all I did was write letters. I never sent him, and I think looking back on it, I could easily have started an affair. He used to walk home with me, and he wrote me very sentimental letters too, until he left and went to another college. But I can remember walking home and wishing he would kiss me, but he never did. So I was firmly convinced by then that no man would ever want me. And I was not the sort of man, the woman that men were interested in. And I suppose I can thank Fordow for that too, because that was the first time that I knew any men well, and two or three of them did get very attentive. So by the time I met Armstead, I suppose I had realized that a man could be interested in me. But I was just as prudish. And it took him a long, long time, very gradually. I think I was unfair to him when I said he was a practiced seducer. He wasn't consciously. This thing was all philosophical with him. He had theories about everything, and he believed them. I will say that he was the most honest man I ever knew in my life. But he simply had trade theories. And he'd got himself into trouble. Twice he'd been sent to mental hospitals by his family. So he really had suffered through what he believed, and it wasn't just that he was a philanderer. It was his theory that the monogamy was evil and that it should be not only free love, but promiscuity.
Well, but why did he believe in an actual legal state of marriage then?
What?
That seems inconsistent to have been legally
married. No, it isn't if you knew all the details. For instance, his first wife was a judge's daughter, and the judge was going to raise Mary Hell if they didn't get married. Things like that.
Now, what was your own attitude towards legal marriage?
Well, the thing was, if I was going to keep on having relations with my family, I'd better be married.
I see.
As a matter of fact, we were married on Armstead and I on the cliff at La Jolla by an unfrocked Congregationalist minister who still had the right to marry people. And our two witnesses were the banker who had the mortgage on our house and a reporter on the San Diego News that Armstead had picked up somewhere. And I had no idea it was going to happen, but the next day the story appeared in the news. Pair wedded on dizzy cliff as careless crowds passed by. Well, and of course they had some biographical stuff, which mentioned I came from Philadelphia, so some stringer sent the story to Philadelphia, to some paper there. And they published it, but since it was several days later, they just dated it that date. So I got an immediate telegram from my mother, "What is the date on your marriage certificate?" I had met a week before.
Now, how about when you married Maynard Shipley? Why did you decide to go ahead and legalize the relationship?
How do you... When I married Maynard, what?
You and Maynard had been living together and had been having a
three
relationship.
3.5 years, yes.
Why did you decide to legalize that relationship?
Neither of us had any opposition to legal marriage that was on our terms. I mean, where we were equals and partners. I haven't yet. I'd have no objection. In fact, I'm still susceptible to being slightly shocked when older people take for granted their children are living together. I met a couple that I know very well, very conservative people, introduced when their daughter came home with a man, and they said, "This is Kathy's boyfriend." And both of them were connected with the police department. I was rather surprised. But you you say, why do people get married? I always want to know, that, on the other hand, why don't you get married? And usually the young people will say now, because either they were once bitten and twice shy, or I will say that I can never remember when I didn't think that you should live with a man before you married him. It's ridiculous to tie yourself legally to somebody that you're not going to make a success of. Certainly to try him out in every way. But as long as we're living in a society where we more or less have to have jobs and wear clothes and meet all kinds of people, and it's simple. It's a lot simpler. Just to, after all, it's easy enough to get a divorce if you want one.
Now, did you write your own marriage ceremony, or did you just go
no,
through the
I never
traditional?
Did. No, my first marriage. I don't remember what the man said, except that it was quite surprised. I was quite surprised when he called me Mrs. Collier. But my second marriage, Maynard was lecturing in Santa Rosa on a Saturday when I didn't work in the afternoon, and those were the days of the 5.5-hour, 5.5-day week. I went up to Santa Rosa in the pouring rain. He met me, and he was on a lecture tour. He was lecturing there, and an old socialist couple who were farmers nearby had stayed with them overnight. And they were the witnesses, and they were horribly shocked afterwards when somebody told them that we'd lived together before we were married. They had a regular little ice cream and fried chicken dinner and all that. But we went to the Santa Rosa, that's the county seat of Sonoma County. We went to the courthouse Saturday afternoon, pouring rain. We got the license all right, but we couldn't find anybody there who was qualified to marry anybody. We finally got the city recorder, an old man with a long white beard. He insisted on kissing the bride. It was like kissing a haystack. But he married us. And it was just a formal. In other words, we knew by that time that we were never going to be separated, and we might just be a lot simpler, especially with jobs to get and all that, and traveling around. I remember before we were married, before we got an apartment together in Baltimore, we used to go to a little third-class hotel near the railroad station. And the first time we went there, I remember how shocked I was. Maynard signed Miriam Collier and husband. But I was still in there in Brighton, and I remember there was no elevator in this building. It was an old place and torn down long ago. I remember we'd have dinner down in the restaurant downstairs, and then I'd run up the stairs to our room, and I always said, why do you do that? So conspicuous, people look at you when you run. They don't look at you, you just walk quietly.
In both of your marriages, you used your husband's name. You only kept the DeFord for writing?
Except as a writer, I've always written under my maiden name. But otherwise, I did. Yes, I was as bonded in the Maryland as Marion Collier. There was no MS in those days. You were Mr. and Mrs. I noticed when Pearl Buck died the other day, the long obituary in the paper called her Miss Buck. Well, she wasn't. She was Miss Seidenstricker once. Buck was her first husband. I notice you use your married name. I suppose that's partly my reason, too, because I have an awful time with my first name. Everybody, for years, I used to have to fight people who call me Marion, which I hate. People can't spell my name. They don't read the Bible anymore. I was named for my maternal grandmother was Miriam Allen.
I see.
Miriam Arnold Allen, but I didn't get all of it, thank goodness. It was understood before I was born that if I was a girl, I'd be named for Grandma. So I was. I hated it. I don't know. My grandmother was one of 15 children, and she was the only one that had a biblical name, so of course I got it. And I don't like biblical names. I'd much rather have a secular one.
I would appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Pictures from the 19... Well, from when you... Some girlhood pictures, maybe pictures, in the 20s. I don't know what you might...
Well, there's something I can do. But write me. You just get somebody to phone. My hearing is too chancy. Sometimes I can hear it, sometimes I can't.
Okay. Well, you don't seem to have had trouble with me.
I have binaural hearing aid, one in each of my glasses. I got more from my grandmother than my name. I got her deafness, too.
Well, your mother was deaf, too, wasn't she?
Well, she got it from her mother, and I got it from her.
But I don't think you had too much trouble hearing me, did you?
Well,
just a few times.
Yeah, people have been easier to hear, yes.
I dropped my voice.
I hear her feet, but I don't always get it. Sometimes I get out of it by begging the question and say, what do you mean specifically?
Yes. Yeah. Well, my mother is deaf, so I'm used to trying to... would it be different? Do you have those photographs in some convenient place, or is it?
Well, I never was photogenic, so I can't promise anything very handsome. these are all the photographs I have of myself from this age.
Do you have one with your whole family?
Not with my family. That's the three of us with our nurse. This is my grandmother and one of my aunts.
Oh.
No, but these tintypes wouldn't be. You could
they I probably wouldn't be able to photograph those.
This is what my mother heard. No, I don't have anything like that.
It could almost be a young woman today, you know? Both
well,
the hairstyle.
Kind
of yes, but the hairstyle and the necklace and the sweater.
Well, this was about 1930s.
Oh.
And I think this one probably is better.
Now, this looks a little bit later, doesn't it? Is that the same time period, you think? That looks a little bit later, maybe.
No, these were all taken the same
time. Oh, they
time.
Were?
Yeah. Taken by the same photographer.
Huh. Very different looking.
Taken by the same photographer. Not very exciting. So I find this Beverly Gill.
Oh!
Party and parades. We used to, at Labor Day, we used to join the Union Parade, you see. I was carrying part of the banner.
Now, where are you? I would like
to. No photograph of me at all.
Well, some of these, I'm interested in pictures which shows the things that the women were involved in. That the Newspaper Guild one would be a good one.
I'll carry the banner.
Do you have any from the suffrage days?
What?
Do you have any photos from the suffrage days?
I thought I lost it. This is I and this is my sister. And that horrid little boy here, he's called a little Willie Skull. And Willie said, horrid little Billy. Oh, this is Billy. I put a circle around him. And this is in the third grade.
There were quite a few black children, weren't there?
Two, much older, you know, and see how tall they are. And nobody ever spoke to them, and they just associated with each other.
Huh.
The rest of us were about 8 years old, and they must have been 10 as well. It was my first friend, Larry Bechtel. Very well. That was when I lived with my grandmother. That was a school affiliated with my sister, my aunts. Stuart did this. This was in the 1940s.
Now, you have something that's fairly recent? Also,
well,
what would be the most recent one you have, too?
Well, most recent one would be this.